Hi, welcome to this week's program. Social Security is always a hot potato issue in this country, and this critical social program continues to lurch from one disaster to the next. Over 22 million people rely on Social Security in the United States, and many of the recipients are among the poorest and most vulnerable people in our society. Yet the ability of Social Security to continue to support the retired, the disabled, and the relatives of the deceased look likely to be severely compromised. A report published last year by the Social Security Board of Trustees documented the demographic shift that will pose serious challenges for the Social Security budget. The vast number of retirees who are living longer, combined with lower fertility rates from younger generations, may combine into a cocktail that spells bad news for the Social Security system. There are currently $2.9 trillion in asset reserves to call upon, which sounds like a lot, but anyone familiar with vast social systems will know that this is nowhere near as much as it sounds. Indeed, projections indicate that by 2034, this money will be completely exhausted, forcing the government to reduce its monthly payout to eligible beneficiaries. Obviously, this is not a very palatable prospect, and it is quite apparent that strong action must be taken sooner or later. But alas, both Republicans and Democrats have been only too willing to kick this unappealing can down the road. And this is not new news. It's something that we've known about for years, for decades, and even for generations. Yet there is little political will to address what is unquestionably an extremely serious conundrum for our society. Now, one possible answer was revealed recently when the Social Security 2100 Act reared its head once more. Representative John Larson's bill was first introduced nearly 5 years ago without gaining much traction in Congress. But with Democrats now in control of the House and 200 Republicans willing to sponsor the bill, there is a possibility that it could be received more favorably this time. The Social Security 2100 Act is intended to reverse the deficit and create a $2.1 trillion surplus. In order to achieve this, 7 key planks of action are proposed, but I'm only going to highlight 5. The first one is, the primary insurance amount formula factor will be increased from 90% to 93% beginning in 2020. Basically, this means that the amount a retiree is due to receive upon reaching retirement would be increased. Now, what this has to do with saving money really escapes me, but there it is. Number 2, the calculation for the annual cost of living adjustment will be switched from the current consumer price index for urban wage earners and clerical workers to the Consumer Price Index for the elderly, which makes adjustments related to seniors age 62 and up. This would more closely track the actual cost of living for those in retirement age bracket. That makes sense to me. Number 3, the proposal would adjust the taxes you have to pay on your Social Security benefit, so the Act would increase the taxation point from $25,000 currently to $50,000 for single filers and from $32,000 to $100,000 for joint filers. So, more of your Social Security benefit will not be taxed because they're raising the threshold. Again, how this saves money, I don't know. Now, here's one that obviously is going to save some money. It would add a new level of taxation to those with earned income above $400,000. So right now, you pay payroll taxes and they're deducted up to a maximum earnings of $132,900 of income. And that would continue. But then again, taxation would start once more for income over $400,000. And then finally, there would be a gradual increase in the payroll tax for all workers from the current 12.9% to 14.8%. Now, none of these proposals are exactly earth-shattering, but when enacted in combination, they could achieve something serious. Criticism that the bill doesn't do enough to help the poor are one of the many of its problems and may prove to be irrelevant because the act is far from certain to pass through the Senate and obtain presidential approval. With the Senate under Republican control, the act may be on life support before it gets anywhere significant. The GOP instead envisages a steady increase in retirement age as a preferred solution to the Social Security issue. Eventually, this would result in Americans becoming eligible for their full monthly payout at age 70. Now, there is precedent for this in other countries. Several European nations have similarly upped the age of their citizens in response to similar challenges. And there's also no guarantee that President Trump would be willing to sign the legislation into existence. While the president hasn't explicitly outlined his perspective on Social Security, he has publicly stated that he believes making direct changes to Social Security would be a dreadful political decision. So all the politics that surround this third rail of policy still seem more motivated by political expedience than a genuine desire to address the situation. Hopefully, with the looming 2034 deadline, this will not be so. But if nothing happens, we'll be back to where we started and kicking the can once more. So I ask you, in this uncertain climate, is it any wonder that there is a Social Security crisis in the first place? Listening to the Steve Pomerantz Show.
As you all know, I spend a lot of time speaking about and educating you all on aspects of retirement. Some of my work is my own and some from others, and when I find a source that has done some deep thinking on the subject of retirement, I like to hear what he or she has to say. So allow me to introduce Robert Laura. He says, quote, he's a social worker turned financial planner, and I believe that. He uses both skill sets to help folks prepare for the mental, social, and physical, as well as financial aspects of retirement. And today we're going to discuss his book entitled The Naked Retirement. Hi, Robert. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. How are you?
So securing a satisfying retirement in today's world requires different tools and ammunition than it did in the past. That's a quote from your book. What do you mean by that?
You know, I think as people have transitioned, it's just not your parents, your grandparents' type of retirement anymore. You really have to look at the everyday life aspects, how to replace your work identity, how to stay connected, how to stay mentally and physically fit. So it's much more than just the dollars and cents. You got to look at the other stuff as well.
And people are living an awful lot longer on average.
Exactly. Just because you're living longer doesn't mean you're healthier. So
yeah,
we want to make sure you're well-positioned to live out those years well.
You know, I was really surprised, but a few weeks ago, we were helping a client with an estate insurance situation. We were advising them and talking with their insurance agents and so on. And illustrations, the insurance companies were required to, in their illustrations, to run them out to age 121. That was shocking, don't you think?
It, you know, and it's a reality people aren't preparing for. Everyone still kind of thinks, oh, I might make it to 82 or 85.
Yeah.
You're going to make it a long time, and you want to make sure you're prepared to make the most of those years.
Absolutely. Now, people have perceptions when they're going into retirement. As a matter of fact, quoted in your book, you state that 75% of pre-retirees expect life in retirement to be better, but only 40% of actual retirees find that to be true. And Robert, that's a major disconnect. How come?
You know, I think a lot of it's because people are, you know, I don't want to say delusional, but they think that, oh, retirement, I'm not going to have the stress, and I'm not going to have to deal with this. And that's not the case. You still have all that same stuff. It's just a matter of you have more time and less distractions.
Yeah.
And so problems can become bigger. And again, I think first we make our habits, and our habits make us. A lot of people want to put off eating healthy or doing things a certain way to retirement, and they get there, there's no extra motivation. So it really is about preparing yourself in all of those areas and just not hoping that things go well.
For those of us who've worked all of our lives and we go perhaps to an office and we have a certain amount of regiment at the office, now you're home, you've got to come up with your own sense of discipline. Also, there's a quote in your book that I found really shocking a little bit and meaningful. And it goes, Bob, don't ever retire, someone told you, because the minute you do, you won't mean anything to anyone anymore. And those were his exact words. You won't mean anything to anyone anymore. What do you say to that, Robert?
It's a wake-up call, you know, because again, I think a lot of people, particularly men, identify with their work. You know, that's where they get their self-esteem. That's who they are. But when you step back, you know, work is what you do, not who you are. And for those people who aren't prepared to replace it, you do end up lost. And I can tell you, Steve, you've pricing this yourself in your practice. You know, when you look at people when they retire, some people wander around aimlessly for years because they have no direction. They have no new passion. And so the book is really about saying, hey, you know, we don't want you to run out of money, but we don't want you to run out of family, friends, and well-being. And you have to do the work. You have to take those extra steps to figure that stuff out.
One thing that I liked about your book is that there were a number of worksheets and kind of thought questions. Can you give us a sample of how you deliver some of this information in terms of getting people to think about their new life?
Well, I think the first part, we don't want to assume we know what is going to happen and what's best for you. And so we want people to uncover it for themselves. And by just posing questions that aren't part of the typical retirement planning process, they can start down that path and start to have conversations about it. It's interesting because even when I ask people in my workshops or when they read the book, you know, describe a perfect day and a perfect week in retirement. And they get to either Tuesday or they get to the afternoon and they don't know what to do. And so, again, that's where they get these, they have these thoughts and ideas about retirement, but they're not truly connected to what it's going to be like. And so it is about taking the time to look at what's a perfect day, what's a perfect week look like, what kind of issues are you concerned about, what kind of habits do you have, and identifying them and starting to put them in place instead of, again, just waiting and hoping they happen.
And those worksheets are in the book, right?
Yep, everyone, they come with the book, and there's an online video. If they don't, you know, basically, I do the webinars and the seminars here in Michigan, but if they want to watch it online, they can watch it online and go through the book as well.
Sure. The book is entitled The Naked Retirement. The author is Robert Lora. Of course, he's with me right now, and he's a financial planner from Michigan. Not to be too negative here, but there's also the dark side of retirement. Looking at some of the stats that you provided, the National Institutes of Health report that of the 35 million Americans age 65 or older, about 2 million suffer from full-blown depression, and another 5 million suffer from less severe forms of the illness. I think it's kind of really reinforcing what you're saying. What should someone do if they find that they're bordering on depression?
Well, I think, you know, for advisors, for family members, even for, you know, new and existing retirees, you got to recognize the symptoms. And again, I think that when you start to look at retirement, people look at it as this iconic time where everything's going to be perfect, and then it's not. And that can really put you in a different spot of what you anticipated. And again, the important thing about the dark side is because there's depression, there's addiction. Suicide rates are the highest for white males over the age of 65. These are the kind of things that happen if you don't do this type of planning. And again, you know, we both make our money as financial professionals, but the key to making sure people live out their lives and use those monies well is having these other things in place, making sure you don't fall victim to addiction. You know, again, when you're retired, every night's a Friday night, right?
Yeah.
Every night's a Saturday night. And then the depression of not being surrounded by the people or having a purpose, and then, again, not replacing who you are, can have a really devastating effect on people.
A lot of men really don't have a lot of friends, and they may count their workmates as their friends or their acquaintances, and then they become retired. And, you know, friendships become even more sparse. So that's an important thing to concentrate on. You have a list of items here I want to go through. You call it the Naked Retirement Plan. Again, congratulations on being able to use the word naked in any conversation about your book. Let's start with number one, retirement bumper sticker. Your first exercise is to create a retirement bumper sticker or mantra that summarizes your new thoughts and feelings about retirement. Give us an example of that.
You know, I think it's important to have a concept of retirement, a metaphor, if you will. And again, I've had a lot of different people say, you know, free at last, or no more alarm clock, or a guy who went through the book and developed a curious list saying, I don't want to fiddle around because you wanted to learn how to play the fiddle. You know, there's lots of little cute ways. But again, I think people need to go into retirement with a positive, reinforcing metaphor that, hey, this is a great time in my life. I need to make the most of it. Not that this is the death sentence and the end of me, because it will influence your thinking and your attitudes.
I like this one. This one's entitled Retirement Conversations. Select the five most important conversations you need to have and list them along with the target person you want to have that discussion with.
You know, this is important because people make their own assumptions about retirement. And some people think you're just sitting around eating bonbons waiting to die. Mm. And that may mean that your kids thinking that you're rich and have all sorts of money to give them, or that you have nothing better to do than babysit their kids, or that could be coworkers who say, hey, you come visit me because you're not going to be busy and I'm working. And so it's a matter of taking those thoughts and having them into actual conversations. Also very important for couples talking about, you know, one of my favorite sayings from the workshops I've done is a wife said, I married him for better or for worse, but not for lunch every day.
Right.
How much time are you going to spend together and apart? Mm-hmm. Are you going to be with the grandkids all the time? Are you going to be on the golf course? Figuring that stuff out is really important.
I agree. I totally agree. And not anywhere near the least important, and you mentioned it a little bit earlier, is this idea of taking good physical care of yourself, listing your 3 to 5 health habits, opportunities, or the concerns that you want to address immediately. Again, if you want to live a long life and you want it to be a satisfying life and stay healthy, it's now time to really start taking these situations seriously. What do you advise people there?
You know, I think it's, you know, before you retire, start establishing those habits. Don't wait till you retire to start working every day and eating healthy.
Mm-hmm.
Do it now. And then also you have to be, you know, cognizant of, you know, we can make our friends, but we can't make our family. So you may have certain health risks that have been passed down. And so just being aware of them and starting to manage them, because, again, when you look at it from a financial planning perspective, is your health going to be an asset or a liability for you? Are you going to be a burden? And are there ways that you can make those changes? And the answer is yes, but it starts now, not later.
My guest is Robert Laura, and his book is The Naked Retirement. He's a financial planner located in Michigan, and it's a good book for you guys to get to really start to kind of concentrate on some of the specific aspects of retirement. And finally, Robert, this idea of developing a spiritual action plan, whether you're religious or not, what do you really mean by that?
It was interesting because someone brought the point to me a while ago that, you know, my book makes retirement to be the ultimate goal, but getting into heaven is. And as I brought that up to my publisher and other people, you know, there was a lot of pushback on, you know, whether there should be a Christian perspective, should you mention heaven. But at the end of the day, retirement is the last phase of life. The guarantee that comes with it is you will die at some point. And so with that in mind, to create a no-regrets retirement plan and to get on a spiritual path, whatever that may be, of what's going to happen. And when you are on your deathbed, you want to be able to look back and say, I did all the things I wanted to do, and I'm ready for this next phase.
Very well said. The book, The Naked Retirement, the author with me right now, Robert Laura. He is a financial planner located in Michigan. Thank you so much for joining us, Robert.
Thanks, Steve. I appreciate it.
I want to take a moment to remind you that any questions about any topic or idea that we've discussed here on this show, you know, go to stevepomerantz.com and ask us a question. We love to hear from you. That's stevepomerantz.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. A recent article in the New York Times caught my attention. It was a discussion of how some people coming off successful careers were using their skills to move into the next chapter of their lives. My guest Jerry Sedlar was quoted in the article, and we've reached out to her to give us some insight into these issues. She's also the co-author with her husband, Rick Miners, of the book, Don't Retire, Rewire, and has been thinking about this and writing about this for over 15 years. Hey, Jerry, welcome to the show.
Hey, good to be here.
So let's get this framed from the very beginning. You have written, retiring is a going from and rewiring is a going to.
So let me explain what we mean by that. I think that a lot of people in the past used to think that retirement was the end. And we just want to get the point across to people. It's the end of maybe a traditional work, maybe your practice, your business, but you're still going to have energy running through your veins. So you need to put that into new or different activities. So that's the idea that you retire from, let's call it your organization, your business, but you rewire to. And that's where we really help people show how to fill in the blanks on that one. It could be new work. It could be volunteering. It could be fun and activities, more with family. But it's really the idea about rerouting that energy into new things, that it's not an end, but it's really a beginning.
Well, everybody is going to have their own path, and it is going to be a period marked by some type of dislocation as you try to transition from one life to another. What are some tools that people can use in order to make this transition as effective as possible?
Well, first, Steve, I want to capitalize and leverage what you just said. It is a change. You're going to feel disconnected. You're going to feel disengaged. And the more that you understand that up front and just go, oh, this is normal, that I think is a very healthy way of looking at this future to begin with. So that's the first thing. I think the second thing is we really advocate that people start thinking about this before they find themselves just thrust into this thing, whether you call it your retirement, your next act. But one of the realities is that through all of our work, we've realized that this is the life stage you really need to know yourself. You need to have self-awareness, and you need to know what we call what makes you tick or what really drives you. Because as much as you said, kind of, you know, it's a journey, it's a path, the truth is it's going to be your journey and your path. There's not as much of a framework as the first part of our lives. There was more of a, like what I'm going to call the trigger points. This one is kind of an open territory. And for some, boy, that is so exciting. And for others, it is so frightening.
When anybody starts out in a career, and, you know, many of us will remember this, there's a lot of failure associated with it. You're learning the ropes and you're young, so you don't really think about failure too much. You just kind of forge ahead and then you find yourself. Isn't there this idea that, you know, you're going into this new territory, but you have to be willing to risk failure in the beginning?
Yes. And that is one of the biggest things that people, audiences have said to us, well, I don't want to make a mistake. We've been taught throughout life, you know, we shouldn't make mistakes and have failures. And first, you got to get over that. Because when people all say, tell me about what you failed at, what didn't work out. And if people say, well, really nothing, and I'll say, then you haven't tried enough. Because this is, quote unquote, supposed to be that life stage where you can begin to experiment, that you can try some things. And the words that we say is, we want you to be curious and then have the courage to begin to execute on some of those new interests or ideas. It's a funny line. I love to say it. This is life. Let the kite out. Just have the guts to explore within reason, Steve. But this is the stage where I want people to say, wait a minute, if I could do anything, what might it be? But not everybody has an answer to that initially. So we always say, too, you've got to try to put some ideas out there in your own head before you try to explore them in life.
Jerry Sedler is my guest. She's the co-author with her husband, Rick Miners, of the book Don't Retire, Rewire. And to find out more about Jerry and to hear this conversation again, don't forget to join the conversation at stevepomerantz.com. One of the key points to your book is, you know, you ask yourself, what really drives you? Why do you really work? And I think discovering that is part of this process. What does that mean?
I'd say it's almost the most important thing, because people normally would say, well, what do you want to do? And it would just be about the activity or the idea. Mm-hmm. But we went and we did this major piece of research to ask people across the country, ages at that time, like 37 to 78, why do you or did you work beyond a paycheck, beyond the money? And unsolicited, we got back 85 reasons. Now, some of them, you know, duplicated themselves a little bit, but some people said, you know, to belong. Others said, I want to be creative. And some said, hey, problem solving. Then some people honestly said, I like the power. I like being a leader.
Yeah, you like the idea of having your own way.
Right. I like the recognition. I like to be valued. And that's where the power is, Steve. If people can take the time, as we do in the book, to go through these and to really get down to your top drivers, and we help people through this because, you know, many people, they get to a certain stage of life, you know, 55, 60, 60, even much younger, they don't really know what turns them on. And the reason it's so important to understand your drivers and identify them is It's a way to know yourself. So when you're looking for those new activities, when you are rewiring too, you're going to have a better idea. Even when it comes to something like volunteering, do you want to be hands-on working in the soup kitchen because you're that kind of a person and that's what drives you? Or would you really rather be on the board of an organization that supports the food kitchen?
Mm-hmm.
Really important to know that, because that's where people make the mistakes, that they don't know,
yeah,
wow, that was really important to me.
I think a lot of people, when they're working, think about retirement and what they would be doing. And we have this very simplistic view. I'm going to play golf all the time. I'm going to sit on the beach. I'm not going to have to worry about this client or that whatever. Yet, when it really comes down to it, it's almost like you can be in panic mode. And it's time to start thinking about, what is it in this limited time left? Now, limited time, I only mean to say, is that we are all mortal. What are my dreams? What further things do I want to accomplish? Or what do I want to satisfy myself with or the people that I love in order to live a full, rich life? How do we get there?
Okay, so those are actually what you've touched on, are exercises. You know, we always hear, well, one day I'll. Well, this is the time to get the notepad, to do whatever, and to begin to write down what were some of those dreams. One day I'll, or if I only had, you know, 5 years, you know, what would it be? Or what's on your bucket list? So a lot of these things are out there, and those are very important. But one of the things we challenge people to is to take a look back. What were some of the things that you accomplished that I want more of those? That felt really good. So we say, what were you doing at the time? Who were you with? Because your audience, your group is really, you know, important too, because this really is a beginning of a process. What we warn people against is don't necessarily eavesdrop off of your best friend's life. Because even though you may be close friends, you may have very different interests, different needs, different financial resources. So there is a part of this journey that we want you to begin on your own. And if you're a couple, begin on your own as individuals and then come together. Because you want to make sure that you're on the same page. And that's where we've seen a fair amount of problems, that through the years, couples haven't always communicated. So now they get to this life stage and It's like, wow, they're at two different places. You know, you can get on the same page, but you really have to have the guts, I'm going to say again, and the courage to put your ideas out there and to say, if I only have X number of what I'm going to call good years left, where do I want to go? What do I still want to see? What will I be bummed about if I don't accomplish?
Now, Jerry, you have a blog, and I was reading through it, and there was a small piece about someone who was, there's a picture of someone fly fishing. And so we're not really talking about necessarily, you know, you must accomplish great things in the rest of the time you have left. We can be talking about the simplest of passions. Give us some idea of what some typical passions people have.
But I'm going to pick up on something because we're working on this blog, and that is there are things called what I call big P's and little P's, and they apply to the word purpose as well as to the word passion. We hear people say, I need a new purpose. But that purpose can be learning to fly fish.
Mm-hmm.
For somebody else, that purpose may be, I'm going to save the world. That's what we mean about this is a very intimate and a very unique life stage. The fly fishing, it's an interesting one. I will say that this is a situation where, you know, somebody really didn't know, do we really want to do something like this? Let's try it. And on these situations, we say, please take a lesson or two, because if you really just try to learn something on your own, sometimes you don't grasp it that quickly. And even, you know, that 50-plus brain does need maybe a little bit of a different way to get engaged.
Mm-hmm.
But not everybody has a passion. So we go, take a small idea, take a little interest. And all of a sudden, if you put some time, effort, energy, and money behind it, that very small interest can flourish into a much bigger idea. But where we see the problem is that people will go and they're looking for the immediate passion idea right in front of them. And I don't really think that happens for that great a percentage of people. I think you have to do some looking around a little bit. But, you know, somebody just said they're leaving their job and, you know, they know where they are from a financial standpoint. But they really said, we really want to just have the time to explore, do different things, and continuous learning is their hot button. So they want to get involved with Rhodes Scholars, which is an organization. They want to all of a sudden maybe go over to Europe and learn things. And they said, or we're going to just, you know, do different things online as a beginning point.
We are unfortunately out of time, but I think the basic idea is go back to what it was like when you started your professional life. Remember all the times you skipped from job to job. You tried certain things until you found something that you can sink your teeth into. Don't be worried about failure. Failure is part of it, but just get started. The book is Don't Retire, Rewire. My guest is Jerry Sedlar. She is a co-author. And Jerry, how do people get to you on the internet to follow you?
I think the easiest, I'll just give my email here. It is jsedlar@don'tretirerewire.com. No punctuation. Mm-hmm. And I love to hear from audiences and readers. And, you know, I'd love to hear from your group.
Thank you so much for your time, Jerry.
Thank you, Steve.
I want to take a moment to remind you that any questions about any topic or idea that we've discussed here on this show, you know, go to stevepomerantz.com and ask us a question. We love to hear from you. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. Terry is a 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So we have seen a downtick in mortgage rates.
Yep.
As a matter of fact, for most of 2018, they hovered around 5%. And now they're hovering in the kind of the below 4.5% range, around 4.4.
Okay, yeah.
Are you seeing any difference in the volume of people looking and selling and buying?
I can tell you right now, from what I see, the activity is very strong. The buyers are out there. I think it has to do with the fact that the interest rate, it did bump up there for a little bit and it came back down. So there's always a pent-up supply of either buyers or sellers. I think the pent-up supply of buyers have noticed that the rates have come back down. They've also noticing there's a little bit increase in inventory. So it gives them a little bit more shopping opportunity.
That's a good thing.
Which is a good thing, very healthy for our real estate market. And that's what we as realtors all have been waiting for, rates to come down and inventory to rise. So it's active. It's very, very active. Getting multiple offers. On median priced homes.
Good.
Yes.
Well, what we had talked about, and I don't remember the exact statistics, but we had said that for every X drop in interest rates or rise in interest rates, that either shuts a certain amount of people out of the market because rates have risen and now their mortgage payments are too high relative to their income, or the reverse, when rates go down, now they can't afford more home, and that, again, is it creates more demand.
That's right.
That's very good. Okay.
So, all good.
So we are seeing that.
We are seeing it.
Okay. Well, that's excellent. All right. So I want to switch gears here, your real estate survival guide, where we go to other areas of the real estate market. And I thought this one was pretty interesting. Here's the question.
Sure.
It is my understanding that tenants step into the owner's shoes and are allowed the same rights as owners, except for voting. It's an interesting way to put it, stepping into the owner's shoes.
Yep.
The questioner asks, is that correct? I'm having an issue with the homeowners association where I'm renting, where they won't allow me to have a pet, but they will allow owners to have pets. Does the association have the right to prohibit tenants from having pets and not owners? If so, are there any other rights that a homeowners association can restrict for tenants?
Excellent question, and this is something we do see. An association is allowed to enforce the provisions of the governing documents as long as the provisions are not discriminatory, right?
Sure.
So the differences between an owner and a tenant's right are usually contained in those governed documents. So in practicality, yes, this is very common, and I don't know even if a lot of realtors realize. So if you've got a client looking for a rental and it says you know, pets are allowed, or you're familiar with a community that does allow pets, don't necessarily assume that that right is granted to the tenants.
That's a big one.
And it is a big one. And then, you know, you find out later that they're not accepted as tenants because they have the pet. So this is very common.
Well, I know, but you can think about, you don't know this. The realtor doesn't know it. You go in, you move in with your pet. And
well, you'll never make it past moving in with a pet because you have to get approved. And so when you write down on your application you have a pet, that's usually when it gets discovered.
Yeah, I mean, I can just see you there. Now what are you going to do? You're going to have to get rid of your pet? A mess, right?
You know, I had something like that, and it had to do with pickups.
What is that? Oh, pickups.
Pickup trucks.
Oh, pickup trucks.
And, okay, I admit I did not know the rule.
Oh.
And
yeah.
Oh, it was a big problem.
You're already in the neighborhood. You already live there.
We had the tenant move in.
Okay.
And I don't think we had to fill out an application. I don't remember all the details, but the bottom line is the tenant had a pickup and we weren't aware of it. So whether or not you're aware of it, if it's a homeowners association, because you don't necessarily have to be given the HOA documents, but as a tenant or as a realtor or as a landlord or anybody listening to this radio show, please look at the HOA documents and know what the rules are before you rent the property out, because you may not own a pickup and you may, you know, say, oh, pickups are allowed.
Yeah.
And then discover that, hey, they're not allowed. You didn't know that they weren't allowed.
Right. And so the day, move-in day,
even motorcycles. I've had that happen with motorcycles.
Yeah.
Motorcycles and pickups are bad. I don't know why. Car discrimination, bike discrimination.
I don't know. It's just, well, first of all, motorcycles can be incredibly noisy.
Yeah.
Nobody wants that. Pickup trucks, you know, I don't know. You know, you're working on your, how about cars in the backyard and stuff like that? I mean.
Now,
it lends a certain...
my family owns pickups, including myself. It's a nice one.
Okay.
It's the most expensive car we own, actually.
I'm actually going to stop talking about it right now.
Those things are $70,000.
Oh, well,
I know.
I know. I understand that Ford, Ram, right? Yeah, they just came out with a 7-foot pickup truck. They're getting ridiculous. All right. So this next piece here is not from me. It's from a person by the name of Peter Dunn. He's an author, speaker, and radio host. And these are not necessarily the thoughts of Terry or myself, but I like what was written here, and I thought there was some good information, so I'm going to go ahead and try to summarize. So the question that was posed to him was, someone said they're currently purchasing a house and noticed that their credit score was 807. One of the items that was hurting the score was the length of the accounts that were open. This person said, I have Lowe's, Home Depot, Discover cards with all zero balances. Should I close them? If so, all at once, or should I filter them over a course of time? And I've always liked having them just in case, but I don't use them very often, if at all, and asked Peter his thoughts. And I will say that I've interviewed lots of credit experts, and they say, keep your credit cards open, because every time you shut your cards, even whether you're using them or not, it hurts your score. Well, Peter Dunn doesn't agree with this.
Right.
So his answer is, you've been bamboozled, tricked, hoodwinked. We all have. Collectively, we've decided we're going to let an otherwise meaningless score mean a lot to us. In the process, we've made decisions that make no sense whatsoever and in turn damage the meaningful signs of financial stability. And it's not your fault, he goes on to say. But if you let me, he wants to take a moment to explain this. You have a score of 807, he says. He says, that's enough. It's fine. Stop. Despite popular belief, the goal isn't to have a perfect score. He hears that all the time. I have perfect credit, someone will say to him, to elicit some kind of a figurative cookie.
Right. Like
you're going to give him a cookie. Good
a
for
trophy.
You. You'll pat him on the head. Good for you. You got a perfect score. But it takes every ounce of restraint for him not to scream back, who cares? It doesn't matter. See, your credit score is no longer a measure of your financial health. More than anything, it's used to gamify your involvement in the selling of your data.
Oof.
Mm. The credit bureaus, or data bureaus, as I prefer to call them, sell what they call your, quote, decision and analytics, end quote, to companies who want to sell you things and want to know exactly how you think. Every time you swipe a card, dozens of data points are captured about your transactions, and those are aggregated over time. They know how much junk food you eat. They know, and you can't get away from that. If you're buying ding-dongs every other Thursday at 8:57 in the morning, they know that. So he goes on to say, this is real. It's not science fiction. He mentions a book, Mark Goodman's Future Crimes, Inside the Digital Underground and the Battle for Our Connected World, And he says, look, the bottom line is close your credit cards if you don't use them. Your credit score will go down temporarily, but it will come back up and get off it, okay?
Yep.
An 800 score is terrific. And anyway, how many times you're going to buy a house, how many times you actually need to use this credit score?
That's right.
That was the answer. And unfortunately, I took us to we're out of being out of time. So Terry, thank you for your patience. And as always, talking to Terry Story, 30-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca, and can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Are you anxious about your financial future? Have you ever made money decisions you've regretted and then repeated the same mistake again? Or perhaps you avoid talking about money altogether? Life is unpredictable, but your decisions don't have to be. And knowing where you stand and having an ongoing action plan will help you get where you want to go. So when you understand that the cornerstone of success is in making good decisions coupled with deliberate action, you can start on the road to ensuring that you're investing the way you should and feel good that you're taking care of yourself and your family in the best possible way. And you know, this has been the mission of the Steve Pomerantz Show from the very beginning. So once again, I want to remind you that you can ask us anything on your mind financially by visiting stevepomerantz.com. And if you have more serious concerns or questions, I'll personally take the time to get back to you to help you find a solution. I've been helping people do just that for 35 years, helping them get ready for retirement, save for a house or college, and so many of life's turning points. So once again, go to stevepomerantz.com and click on Contact. That's stevepomerantz.com.
Investment advisory services are offered through United Capital Financial Advisors, a registered investment advisor. United Capital and the Steve Pomerantz Show are separate and unrelated companies.
You're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. Mad Men co-producer Josh Weltman has just published his first book based on the insights of his 25 years in the advertising business. He's worked as creative director, co-producer, writer, and artist, and has created the ad campaigns for Taco Bell, Doritos, BMW, Microsoft, and Whole Foods, to name a few. Now, Josh has been part of Mad Men since the show's first season, and he works closely with Matthew Weiner and the show's writers and producers to help ensure that Mad Men accurately depicts the process of creating ads and servicing clients. He also creates most of the original ads seen on the show. His new book is Seducing Strangers, How to Get People to Buy What You're Selling, and he joins me now. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So the world of advertising has changed a little in these years that you've been practicing. What is different and what has stayed the same?
Well, I think the media is the thing that's changed the most. I mean, the digital revolution and online media is the thing that's most different. And human nature, what makes people buy things, has probably changed the least. You sort of have those two things clashing together right now.
Do you think that most people who are really not trained in this area are spending more time on the technology, but they're forgetting what compels people to buy?
I think that's exactly right. You know, I wrote the book because most people today don't feel equipped to craft messages or take action with the same confidence and certainty as Mad Men's Don Draper. And I think it's two things that confound them. I think, first, that most people are a lot less familiar with the principles of persuasion than they are with the means. And what I mean by that is, you know, everybody listening knows how to send 140 characters to millions of people around the world, but they don't really know what makes a message persuasive and what doesn't. And the second thing that confounds people is the recent and rapid changes in new digital media technology doing the job hard for even experts who do understand the principles of persuasion. There's just so many different platforms and media to choose from. Clients and businesses and people are very confused about what's the best media to do the job.
The fact, too, is that there is so much more noise that has to be parsed through or broken through in order to get your message out there. What does one really have to do in order to solve that problem?
Well, it's tough because, you know, to break through and to get people to notice you, you have to be surprising. And to come up with a message that's both surprising and informative is really the art of the advertising and communication business, you know, even the entertainment business. You want people to tune in and not be able to take their eyes off the television show because they're familiar enough to love the characters and can't possibly imagine what they're going to do next.
Right. The book is Seducing Strangers, How to Get People to Buy What You're Selling. My guest is Josh Weltman. He is the co-producer on the TV show Mad Men. Josh, you mentioned in your book that so many people say to you that advertising is lying, but you take you take exception to that. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it doesn't really help companies or products or brands in the long run to lie. You have to base a successful advertising or persuasive campaign on some human truth, you know, on something inside people that makes them want to buy the product or service. And if you don't get that right, you know, people listening are just going to call BS right away, you know, so it does not do you, your company, or anybody's reputation any good to lie. It's also illegal, you know. I think people get lying, you know, confused with sort of puffery, you know, that sort of thing. What you want to do is you want to set expectations at a level that products and services can meet or exceed, because I think that's what makes people happy. You know, when reality meets or exceeds their expectations, you get a happy customer. So better than lying is to adjust the bar to kind of the right level.
What is the basic motivation for someone who's trying to get the message out? Not the motivation so much, but the message to a potential customer. What do they want that customer to feel?
Well, that's a great question. I think it depends on what business result they're trying to achieve with the message. I've always found that there have been about four of those different business results and four different kinds of ads that kind of inspire them. You either want people to inquire about the ad. You want to increase inquiries or clicks or phone calls or something like that. And that's usually a new product.
Curiosity.
Or you want to bump sales or traffic immediately, you know. And to do that, you have to impart or evoke a sense of urgency. And you do that with limited time offers or deals or things. Most common in what we really think of advertising is when companies are trying to distinguish themselves from other choices that consumers have. You know, they're trying to answer that question for customers of what makes them different. And in those ads, you're trying to make people familiarize people with the one unique feature that makes your product or service different from anybody else's in the market. And in the fourth kind of ad, you're trying to protect margins or increase margins by making people feel like they're part of an exclusive club, you know, sort of in partnership with an advertiser or company of which they're of like mind and shared values.
So as you're speaking, some companies come to mind. Some of the more obvious ones like Starbucks comes to mind. That's a club. Apple, of course, comes to mind. Can you take us through very briefly how, let's say, an Apple is able to achieve these four aspects of good messaging?
Oh my God, Apple's the best at it. Whenever they come out with a new product, the first thing they do is buy lots of billboards that really make you curious about seeing that product. You know, so that's the first thing you want to do is you want to show people enough of the product to make them curious, but not so much that you've answered every question because you want them to inquire further about it. And the next thing that you typically do is get them to try it. I remember when, geez, a long time ago, probably before most of the listeners were born, but the 1984 spot that introduced the computer Macintosh was such a success in the third quarter of the Super Bowl in 1984. But then Apple did a brilliant thing, which is they followed that ad up with a limited time offer called Test Drive a Macintosh, where, you know, they made these Macs available for people to take home and try and get their hands on. And you know, as if you were test driving a car, they really wanted people to experience it. So then the third sort of ad in the process is, again, make people familiar with the one most unique thing about it. And the fourth kind of ad is make people celebrate the difference between your customer rather than your product. Talk about what makes your customers unique. You know, you get to that part of the relationship between the consumer and the company where the advertising is really saying, you know, enough about me and what I make. Let's talk about you and why I'm so happy to have you as a customer. Apple is their Think Different campaign, I would say, would fall into that category.
Well, I don't see Apple offering us free anything these days. I guess they don't have to, right? Back then they had to, but not these days.
Everything. Oh, no. That was before they had retail stores that were packed with people who had their hands all over the things now. Yeah. You know, they came up with a different way to get people in the store and get their hands on the product.
The book is Seducing Strangers, How to Get People to Buy What You're Selling. The author is co-producer for the show Mad Men. I mean, he shares his 25 years of insights to the advertising business and also helps Mad Men get it right. Very briefly, what is your actual role at Mad Men?
I started out as the first advertising consultant on the first season. I was joined by a second advertising consultant named Bob Levinson the second season, and both Bob and I have been with the show, you know, through the completion, season 7. And what we do is we work with the writers and executive producer, Matt Weiner, to make sure or try and help make sure that the show accurately depicts the process of creating ads and servicing clients. And then we come up with the business stories that get the characters emotionally where Matt wants to take them.
You know, I did read that the idea behind John Hamm's character is that he's so flawed in every other aspect of his life, at least we can trust that he's going to get the advertising part right.
That's been very important to Matt and the show, I think, from the get-go, that Don is good at his job.
Right.
You know, people want to root for him. They've seen him be brilliant. They like when he's succeeding, and it breaks the audience's heart and heart for him, you know, when he gets in his own way.
You know, going back 2,500 years to Aristotle, you bring up a point in your book of something that he developed called the enthymeme, which is a two-part statement which both confuses, then explains. And if I may, let me just read this. Here's a typical sentence. London has everything a man could possibly want to see or do, but instead it can be written, and it was written by a great writer, when a man is tired of London, he is tired of life. Explain that to us in advertising way.
Sure. What that's talking about is the idea that you have to intrigue people and get them curious about hearing your message. And the idea of an enthymeme is, like you said, a two-part statement, where if the first part confuses, the second part explains. And if the first part explains, the second part confuses. So you hang on every word to get the whole thing, like the setup and the punchline of a joke. But one of the things that I noticed doing when I first started advertising is this same idea was being used in modern advertising with a little bit of a twist. What was going on was in print advertising, if the visual confused, then the headline would explain.
Yeah.
And if the headline confused, then the visual would explain. And the idea is, with those two pieces working together, people would sort of be flipping through a magazine and suddenly there's this discord, there's this confusion in front of them, and they had to sort of stick with the headline or concentrate to figure out what was going on. And as soon as they figured it out, they're sucked in.
Yeah.
You know, you've kind of got them. And it was breaking the ads apart into these two-part concepts where the visual and the words and the visual were working together to create one idea, neither the words or the visual could do it completely themselves, was really the creative breakthrough that was going on in the 60s, when we opened the show of Mad Men. That sort of thinking was just beginning to happen.
Well, you mentioned in your book, or you show the ad for Volkswagen. Now, again, this is way before many of our listeners would have been alive, but a big, basically white space on a full page with a small little Volkswagen in the upper left-hand corner. Just take a few seconds to tell us about that.
Sure. And what's funny about that ad is you have to sort of picture the ad in a magazine with tons of ads and tons of images, and you're flipping through, and suddenly you get this big white blank page with a little teeny car in it, and it was confusing to people. They didn't know what to make of it. You know, was it a mistake, or was it a misprint or something like that? And then the headline, which was Think Small, explained what they were looking at, which was, it's a small car, which was kind of a revolutionary big idea at the time. But it's still that same principle of confuse people with the picture and explain with the headline that I was trying to illustrate in the book.
We don't seem to see enough of that these days. We see lots of bright, flashing, quick-moving images. Sometimes I think a little silence could help us all pay a little bit more attention.
Well, I think when, you know, people get nervous and timelines get shorter and everybody's watching the sales of every quarter, people feel that they don't want to let their customers discover, or they don't want to take anything for granted, you know, and they're not as willing to sort of play with people and include them and their intelligence in the process of getting to know the advertising and being a part of the message.
Ironically, it's like going back to the 1800s where they had every single ad, had every single piece of information you'd ever need to know about a wheelbarrow or a toolbox,
exactly.
Right? You know? Unfortunately, Josh, we are out of time, but let me say the book again. This is a fascinating book. Anybody who owns a business, is interested in marketing, and needs to understand the power of advertising and how to use it. The book is Seducing Strangers, How to Get People to Buy What You're Selling. Josh, what a pleasure. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
I want to take a moment to remind you that any questions about any topic or idea that we've discussed here on the show, you know, go to stevepomerantz.com and ask us a question. We love to hear from you. That's stevepomerantz.com. I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Malzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform, and of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. Any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.